This is NHL Midweek,
the podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
And the puck is picked up by Lowry. He sends it all the way down, and the horn will sound. Winnipeg will hang on and win a hockey game tonight. The home opener is a success. The final score here tonight, as Winnipeg gets back above 500 to 2-1 of the season. The Winnipeg Jets 2, the Los Angeles Kings 1. A heck of a hockey game tonight in downtown.
Good evening, Winnipeg. Good evening, Manitoba. For all those joining us live this evening at TSN1290.ca and via the iHeartRadio app, we say good evening, universe, and welcome to NHL This Week. That was the call from last night. Paulie Edmonds, our good friend, with the broadcast here on TSN 1290. The Winnipeg Jets victorious in their home opener by a 2-1 margin over the Los Angeles Kings. They bounced back from that disappointing effort on Saturday evening in Dallas to send the hometown fans home happy last night. I'm your host, Drew Mindell. We welcome you to NHL This Week. Alongside me in studio, my regular colleague, Ezra Ginsberg, and on our far left, the man we call Sean Assor. In fact, his parents probably call him Sean
Assor
as well.
Actually.
Yeah, it's your name and all, so you know, we might as well call you that. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve. That's the best way to reach us here in studio. And of course, our website with the latest Winnipeg Jets news and audio. We have some Manitoba Moose news and audio as well when it's relevant. That's LegalCurve.com. I say good evening to Ezzy. Good evening to Sean. Gentlemen, nice to see you on this Wednesday night.
Drew, how much are you getting paid to babysit?
You're going to zing me right off the start? I'm not getting paid anything to babysit. It's a funny joke. I'll explain the joke. This past weekend, we were in Dallas for the Jets game, and we were celebrating our friend Hart, who's getting married. So it was his bachelor party. And
Shout out to Hartsy. Great bachelor party.
Great bachelor party. So we were out in Dallas this weekend and, you know, watching the Jets and the Stars, and we were out at the Red River Showdown between Oklahoma and Texas. That was a hell of a football game, 48-45.
That looked crazy.
Texas defeating Oklahoma after Oklahoma staged a 3-touchdown comeback in the last 5 minutes of the fourth quarter.
The Cotton Bowl, baby.
The Cotton Bowl. So the Friday evening, we were out for a few drinks, and we're sitting down at this sort of communal table of people, and I'd had a few at that point in time, Mr. Ginsberg, so I was being responsible by not having more than my acceptable amount. So
well, you have to back up a little bit here. Tell everyone what the name of the bar was.
It was called Backyard, but what does that have anything to do with it?
And the fact that we also had just previously ordered bottle service.
Well, there's no need to tell that part of the story.
Well, the point is there was a lot of alcohol on the table.
I said...
You have to set the context.
Well, I said I was being responsible and I'd had a few, so I think the context was pretty clear that people understood what was going on, that we were at a bachelor party. I think I don't need to draw that vivid of a picture for people that they know there was alcohol all involved.
You have to paint some picture.
You guys are the worst storytellers.
No, I'm a very good storyteller. I just have Yuckle the Clown over here interrupting me throughout the story. In any event, long
Yuckle
story
the
short.
Clown. Yeah, there's no Yuckle the Clown.
You could be Yuckle the Clown. Long
there's
story.
There's Bozo the Clown.
I know there's Bozo the Clown, Ezra. You might be the inspiration for Bozo the Clown if you don't let me finish this story that nobody cares about to begin with.
I think I can take over from here.
Go ahead.
So we're sitting at this table, and there's a bunch of girls beside us. I have no idea why they were sitting beside us, but one of the girls leans over to Drew and says, "How much are you getting paid to babysit?" And Drew was kind of, you know, taken aback, and what do you mean babysit? And she says, "How much are you getting paid to babysit that beer?"
So yeah, a 21-year-old college kid zinged me, which, you know, whatever, it's not that big of a deal, you know. Ezzy seemed to enjoy it very
much.
That's
an amazing line.
It was a pretty good line. Yeah. The best line she had, though, and we certainly don't condone this, after she had her fifth or sixth shot or something, she said, "Oh, no more for me. I have to drive." So we certainly don't condone that
so
behavior.
So we did find Bozo the Clown.
Yeah, exactly. We found Bozo the Clown.
Wasn't she our Lyft driver?
She's in Dallas, Bozo the Clown, but we don't condone that kind of misbehaving and irresponsibility with alcohol.
That is good.
It's just good that we were both allowed to go by our wives, because you've got two kids and I've got a 4-month-and-a-half-old daughter, so I don't know how we actually went, but Dallas is a great city and we had a great time.
Well, clearly, we're obviously not that useful when it comes to parenting, and two, our wives are much better people than we are, because if our wives said to us, "We're going to leave you alone with our children for a weekend," I think both you and I would end up just rocking back and forth, you know, crying having to deal with that. But thank you to our wives for, of course, letting us go. And a great weekend was had in Dallas. Nice to always see the Jets on the road, experience them in a different environment. Great arena, beautiful rink down there in Dallas as well. They really did a great job, you know, showing off the game in Texas.
You know, and to get serious here and actually get to the hockey games, I mean, that was obviously a very disappointing loss for the Jets in Dallas. And I thought their response was really good. And right off the bat, you know, congrats to Mark Scheifele for scoring against the Kings, a team that he's never scored against. It's pretty incredible to think that he still hasn't scored against a team with all of the points he's put up, Drew. But, you know, you look at that score, and if you didn't watch the game, you'd probably think it was a defensive battle.
You're talking about last night's 2-1 victory.
Yes, I'm talking about the game last night against the Kings, the home opener. And for the most part, with the exception of maybe a couple of minutes, 2 or 3 minutes in the first period, it was all Jets. And I think you could really see how much quicker and skilled the Jets are, Sean. And I realize that Jeff Carter's healthy and, you know, Jonathan Quick had some injury problems last year and they've brought in Ilya Kovalchuk, but Ilya Kovalchuk and Jeff Carter aren't spring chickens.
Mm-hmm.
And Ilya Kovalchuk was never, you know, the fastest skater. Maybe you go back to his early mid-20s and he was, you know, a little bit quicker, but this is a guy that's relied heavily on his shot. And, you know, Jeff Carter's obviously a guy that's had some speed, but I thought you could really see how much slower the Kings were. And, you know, that top line of Connor, Scheifele, and Wheeler, let's be honest, they didn't have their best game on Saturday night in Dallas. And I thought they were really strong.
Mm-hmm.
And I also thought the TLC line was very strong again. I mean, Brandon Tanev, you can say whatever you want about him. I realize that, you know, last year he had the great playoffs and all of that. But that pass to Mark Scheifele, that was a beauty pass. He's not just a checker. He's showing you that he's got that offensive ability. So I thought that those two lines were excellent, and I know we're going to get into, you know, Nikolaj Ehlers, Brian Little, and Patrick Laine later. They didn't, I think, have their best game. They weren't bad, but I didn't think that they were generating enough offense. So a very nice bounce-back game, and, you know, I thought the Jets did a good job of limiting LA's chances. Whenever you're able to limit a team to 17 shots, you're doing something right.
Right. You know, Kings coach John Stevens was quoted after the game saying, you know, that he, coming into the game, he was encouraging his team to, you know, play with speed and don't be on their heels. They'd been too much on their heels, he said. And he said post-game, you know, we were still on our heels. You can't win in the NHL being on your heels. And I think that's just the Jets' speed and the Kings' lack of speed, especially in the second period. I mean, that second period was as one-sided of a period as you're going to see. And if it wasn't for Jack Campbell, I mean, that's probably a three-goal, four-goal win for the Winnipeg Jets. Jack Campbell kept the Kings in that game, much like he did last year. If you recall, he played a game in Winnipeg as well where he stole a point. I think it was for the Kings against the Jets, a game that went into overtime where he played an exceptional game as well. So Jack Campbell's obviously likes playing at Bell MTS Center. Hasn't resulted in wins necessarily for him, but he's been keeping his team in games where they didn't otherwise belong.
And, Shawnee, Jack Campbell was a former first-round pick, mm-hmm. so I don't know why anybody thought that, you know, LA was going to come in here with Jack Campbell and the Jets were going to put 6 or 7 by him. He's still a great goalie, and they've also got Peter Boudreau backing him up.
You know what kind of impressed me yesterday? And yeah, Jack Campbell played amazing. The Jets poured the shots on as the game went on, but I never realized how, I guess until you see it live, how physical of a player Drew Doughty is. He is a menace out there. Ask Mark Scheifele. I believe, oh no, it was Jeff Carter that hit Josh Morrissey on the play that resulted in the Scheifele goal. Morrissey took a serious hit on that play, but there was some physicality to this game. It was a fun kind of Western Conference-style game, and I wanted to get your guys' takes on what Drew Doughty said pregame yesterday about the way the game is going, and he says it's all about speed and less about brains now, and is that just maybe a guy trying to, I don't want to say rally a team that doesn't have the foot speed?
Well, I don't know that I agree with that comment because I think hockey sense matters still to a great degree.
That's what
I think that's what the Jets have always sort of put a premium on two things: one, speed, and two, hockey sense. I mean, if it was just about speed, there's a lot of guys who've been fast in the NHL who, you know, just end up skating right through the end boards because they don't really know what's going on the ice.
Maybe so, what we saw Brandon Tanev his first year here.
Maybe reckless, you know, almost a little too reckless with their speed. And maybe even a guy like Nikolaj Ehlers, who is unbelievably fast, but is now talking about maybe slowing down his pace a little bit more so that he can let the game come to him a little bit more. It's not always about being, redlining it at 180 miles an hour.
One another thing that has to be mentioned, Shawnee, and I think you make a good point, because we remember those 2012-2014 teams, and that was probably the end of that kind of
big, heavy
Brady style of hockey where you could rely on your cycle and all that and your big strapping defensemen. Remember, they had guys like Robin Regier and Matt Green. And
it's funny. I was watching the game yesterday, and I saw 24 on the Kings. I'm like, is that Robin Regier? I'm like, oh, wait, no, it's not 2005.
Well, yeah. And, you know, the strength of this team is defense, right? And, you know, Ilya Kovalchuk's goal was a beautiful goal. A really nice pass.
That was such a nice
goal. I thought
he
looked better. It's talking about Kovalchuk, because obviously we haven't seen him in the NHL.
He definitely looked lighter.
He looked lighter. I thought he looked better than I expected him to look. I mean, I still question the wisdom of giving him that contract necessarily, because what's he going to look like in game 75 or game 70 in the middle of a grind of a season as he gets older?
In the West.
But I thought Ilya Kovalchuk was more impressive than I expected him to be, and certainly looked like he belonged in the NHL more than I expected him to be.
Well, and I think really the Jets separate themselves from the Kings on the third and fourth lines. I mean, guys like Kyle Clifford and Nate Thompson. I mean, the Jets are able to put out Christian Vesalainen, Jack Roslovic, and Matthew Perreault on their third line. I mean, that's just a much more skilled third line. And the Jets' fourth line, the TLC line, it's a better fourth line than the Kings, right? So that's where you see the Jets' depth is better than the Kings. So, you know, a really impressive effort. And, you know, going back to what we were talking about before, sure, the game is all about speed now, but it's about pressure. It's about discipline. I mean, it's taking advantage of your opportunities. The Jets gave up 3 goals on 5 power play opportunities for the Stars, and they only took 1 penalty yesterday.
Yeah. So, and that was a delay of game penalty.
Right.
They took a second one, Tyler Myers.
Sure, right. Myers high stick
that,
late. Sorry.
That kind of nervous. You know,
sorry, too, Shawnee.
Kind of made the crowd a bit nervous. I mean,
well, of course, it's a one goal game.
Jets dominating a one goal game, and all of a sudden they got to kill a 2-minute penalty.
But the penalty kill was what you had become used to seeing last year, where everything is to the outside. Mm-hmm. None of the seam passes work. Everything is, the Jets are able to get it out of their own zone. It was a penalty kill that was reminiscent of what the successful penalty kill that they had last season, as opposed to what we saw on Saturday night in Dallas. But, you know, from the start, Saturday night in Dallas,
off.
They were off. Mm-hmm. The only time that you maybe thought that they had a pulse was when Brandon Tanev scored shorthanded, but then, of course, it was waved off immediately. That was for really the only pulse the Jets showed where you thought that they might be able to get back into that game. So they had a bad performance in Dallas, and that's what you saw from this team so often last year. They followed up a bad performance with a victory. They never let a bad performance leak into a second or a third bad performance and begin to go on a bit of a tailspin. And that's the difference between good teams, and that's the difference between bad teams, is that good teams can nip those slides in the bud before they become a problem, whereas a bad team, all of a sudden, you lose 3 and 4 in a row. When we come back, we talk about the Jets' forward lines, talk about the Jets' D pairings through the first 3 games of the season. You're listening to NHL This Week. We are live on TSN Radio 1290.
This is NHL Midweek,
the podcast
on TSN 1290.ca.
It's been a project here going back into late January of last year. We think that Nicky's game changes as his mentality of, as a shooter is there when he's feeling like the shooter on the line, then he changes his, the way he approaches the puck, the way he attacks certain areas of the ice.
Jets head coach Paul Maurice talking about Nikolaj Ehlers. Jets still trying to get that some chemistry between Nikolaj Ehlers and some of his line mates. Struggles have continued really through the preseason. He had that one good game in the preseason and off to a bit of a slow start so far in this regular season. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. This segment brought to you by Dr. Les Rikus and the team at Linden Market Dental Center, official dentist of Illegal Curve Hockey. Don't be an Ezzy. Always wear a mouth guard and give yourself peace of mind protection, as well as facial, teeth, and mouth protection. To make an appointment to get your teeth tooting, visit LindenMarketDentalCenter.com. So, Nikolaj Ehlers started the season playing with Jack Roslovic and Christian Vesalainen. That experiment didn't really last very long at all. Last night he was back with Brian Little and Patrick Laine. We sort of expect to see him, or we were used to seeing him. Matthew Perreault down playing with Roslovic and Vesalainen. Dmitry Kulikov, who had been a regular in the lineup last year prior to his injury, he's been a healthy-ish scratch so far this season, where they said yes, if it was in a pinch, he could play or he would play, but you know they're all healthy on the back end, so they're able to sort of to give them some more time to get back up to speed. What are your thoughts on the Jets' line so far, in particular the forward lines and the continued attempts to get Nikolaj Ehlers going and to find that chemistry between on the second line with Little and with Laine and whomever else?
Right. Well, Nikolaj Ehlers doesn't have any points in the first three games. And the problem that I have with that line is if you have Nikolaj Ehlers playing with Jack Roslovic and Christian Vesalainen, I think the problem is you have three players that are extremely young. Jack Roslovic has never played a full season in the NHL. Christian Vesalainen, this is his first three games in the NHL. So when you're talking about Little, Ehlers, and Laine, that's who we expected. When I watch Nikolaj Ehlers, and you saw it yesterday, and this is not just me, this isn't going to be some type of revelation. I mean, Ehlers is one of the fastest guys in the league. He's got a great shot. He's a great playmaker. I think he has to do more to get to those open areas, and he has to drive to the net and get into that slot that we hear about, those high-danger scoring areas. We just don't see that enough. So you mentioned it earlier, we don't want to get too excited about three games, right? Mm-hmm. We don't want to get too excited, but you know, Dennis and Kevin Sawyer were talking about it a lot. Nikolaj Ehlers has only scored, what, two goals in his last 30 games? I mean, he's in a big-time scoring slump right now. So, I mean, Paul Maurice mentioned it earlier today. I think we're going to play that clip, Drew. When you're talking about this line, I mean, he's not going to overreact after one or two or three or four games. I mean, they have to find a way to start putting the puck in the net. Right now, the Connor Scheifele-Wheeler line and the Tanev-Lowry-Kopp line are driving the bus right now. I don't think the third line's been that great, to be honest with you, either.
You look at the time on ice, you could make the argument yesterday that the Tanev-Kopp-Lowry line was the Jets' second line.
Based on time of ice, without a doubt.
Time of ice and importance of their role on the ice. I would go as far, and how dominant they were, I would say that that was a more productive second line than the Ehlers line, a Little line that really, again, had trouble keeping possession of the puck, cycling it, and when they lost it, getting it back.
Brandon Tanev averaging 15 minutes, 35 seconds. Andrew Kopp, 15:03. Adam Lowry, 14:49. Ehlers, Perreault, Roslovic, Vesalainen are all significantly below that mark in terms of their time on ice through three games. So, again, a small sample size. Brian Little is sixth on the Jets forwards in time of ice, 15:14. But as a centerman, it's to be expected, and proficient in the faceoff circle, it's expected that he would have that kind of more time on ice than some of those wingers. Let's hear from Paul Maurice. This is earlier today, talking about the need to get Nikolaj Ehlers and the need to get the second line going.
And Nick Ehlers, with all that skill, since last March, he has four goals. You called him, I think you referred to him as a bit of a project yesterday. What did you mean by that, and what's the plan going
forward? Well, it's the bench rot concept. You know, take what you are really, really good at and protect that and do that on a nightly basis. All the things that we think we need to clean up and help, we can get better with that over time as long as what you're really good at is of value to us. And with Nicky, he is a dynamic player. He's a dynamic shooter, and we want him to be that threat all the time on the ice. The defensive parts of it, sometimes we give a little bit up there, but playing them in the hole that they're in, they should be a really big advantage for our team. So we've seen Nick be that dynamic player. There are times you can go a stretch of games without scoring and still be that player, the other players around you. But I think as a group, they haven't, and it's not, for me, it's not a chemistry. We haven't been at the point where we can judge their chemistry yet in terms of their style of play. And there's some simplicity that has to come into their game. And when that happens, then we'll decide whether they're a real good line together.
How much time do you give it?
4 or 5 years. Good players. I'm not going to tear that one up too early.
That's Jets head coach Paul Maurice. You're listening to TSN 1290. This is NHL This Week with Illegal Curve Hockey. We're talking about the Jets forward lines and the deployment of the forwards through the first three games of the regular season.
And guys, let's call a spade here. I mean, Brian Little, Nikolaj Ehlers, and Patrick Laine did not have a lot of success last year.
They did not. I'm not sure at this point why the expectation would be that that's going to change.
I'll say this much. When you're looking at the line combinations, what are your options right now? Let's talk about their options.
Sure.
At second line center. I mean, your options, as far as I'm concerned, are you move Jack Roslovic up to that second line, you move Adam Lowry up to that second line, or you move Blake Wheeler from right wing to center. Now, if those are your three options, I guess you could throw in a fourth. It would be Matty Perreault.
As a centerman.
But Matty Perreault's been a winger for the last, what, 3 years?
Yeah.
So I think you have three options if you're not using Brian Little there. It's Blake Wheeler.
Yeah.
It's Jack Roslovic.
Mm-hmm.
Or it's Adam Lowry. Now, then you have to ask yourself, well, what is the most realistic option here that will bring success?
Well,
and to me, there isn't an answer that doesn't hurt another line, because right now, I would argue, the Connor Scheifele-Wheeler line is a top five, maybe top three line in the NHL. When you're talking about Jack Roslovic, I mean, you're going to put a guy in that second line center role who has very little NHL experience. What does he have? 35 games of NHL experience.
Yeah, but you can shelter him. Hey, I mean, you're not wrong, but here's my thinking on this. You know what you have with Brian Little, with Brian Little, with Ehlers and Line A, and this thus far it is, at best, it's been you get average results out of it. And you want to protect Christian Vesalainen because he's a young player.
He hasn't been great.
He hasn't been great, but he's only been playing 7 minutes a game. It's hard to really evaluate somebody on 7 minutes a game.
And you have realistic expectations.
Why don't you play him with... If you play Vesalainen with Perreault and Little, you're playing him with two veterans who you know you can deploy in all situations, veterans that Paul Maurice can rely on, veterans that can teach Christian Vesalainen how to play the game the proper NHL way. Pretty good mentors for a young player. And then as a result, you take Jack Roslovic and you put him in center between Line A and Ehlers, and you see what you have. And you can shelter their minutes, because I get the point that you don't want Jack Roslovic to be, you know, as another young player just learning how to be a center in the NHL, you don't want him to be in bad situations. But you give him offensive zone starts. You give him starts of that nature where the team is, you're at an advantage to begin on the faceoff. Meanwhile, you give Perreault and Little and Vesalainen a little bit of maybe harder starting situations, but it's no big deal, or not as big of a deal, because Vesalainen is insulated with the two veteran players. I just don't think you can give Jack Roslovic 8 minutes and 55 seconds and Christian Vesalainen 7 minutes and 6 seconds a game and really know what you have there.
Or see any major development. Like, it's hard to develop with minutes like that.
But you give Roslovic some minutes with Line A and with Ehlers, well, you see if that can be your line, if that can be your second line. Because right now there's no reason to break up Connor, Scheifele, and Wheeler. They're that good. But you need to find somebody to play with Line A and Ehlers.
And I think it will happen. And I said before the season I thought it was going to happen. I just don't think it's going to happen yet.
You think we see it maybe a little more with the 6-game homestand, when the Jets can have an extended homestand where they can control the matches and control the lineups?
That's a good point.
I think that's a very good point, Sean, because, you know, you've been on the road for 3 of your first 4 to start the year, obviously. And when you're on the road, you don't get last change. You don't get to put your players into the ideal situations. Meanwhile, the next 6 games at home, it would not surprise me if you see that. You get and you bump up everybody's ice time as a result, because anybody playing with Brian Little, i.e., in this instance, Christian Vesalainen and Matthew Perreault, are going to get more than, you know, 10 minutes of ice time, because Little deserves it. Little demands it, you know, not demands it, but demands it by the way he plays in the faceoff circle and the responsibility that he has on the defensive side of the zone. And as a result, you get Roslovic and you get Ehlers and you get Line A some offensive zone time and some good situations to see if those three guys have chemistry together.
Drew, in theory, based on Roslovic's skill set,
yeah,
and it seems like he should improve that line.
Mm-hmm.
He should get the most out of Nikolai Ehlers and Patrick Line A because he's a fast, skilled player. All I'm saying is I don't know if Paul Maurice does that in game 4, 5, 6, 7. He might wait. And now also, it's not a guarantee that he's going to click with those two players.
And if he doesn't, then you're back to the drawing board, mm-hmm. and you have to look at the whole situation again, because who knows what happens at that point in time. When we come back, the Jets are in Nashville tomorrow to play the Nashville Predators. Willie Donick is the Predators play-by-play broadcaster. He's going to join us to talk about the Preds' start to the season. You're listening to NHL This Week. We are live on TSN Radio 1290.
This is NHL Midweek,
the podcast
on TSN 1290.ca.
So the last cup you won was in 03, I think, there.
02.
02. 02. Last time I checked, I was in the league, there was no salary cap. So you can't even begin to talk about we kept the band together. Your 02 team had like 14 Hall of Famers on it. You had Robitaille making $6 million in the fourth line. You had 2.5 times the payroll of anyone else but the Rangers.
TSN's Mike Johnson and Craig Button on Leafs Lunch with Andy Petrillo. I think that was from last week.
It's getting heated on that show. They've got some arguments.
Mike Johnson was getting heated. I liked it.
Gordon Miller also getting involved throughout the week.
You know, I enjoy it because it's honest radio. Mm-hmm. And it's not contrived, and that clip in particular, and that scene in particular, which is available on the TSN website, and I encourage you to go check a look at it if you haven't seen it yet, was honest. I mean, Mike Johnson's a former player.
He's great.
Listening to Brendan Shanahan, who once was a former player, tell players that they shouldn't get every dollar that you know they're worth for the good of the team. And then trying to use his own examples, which are a complete apples and oranges situation, mm-hmm. As the justification. I mean, for those of you just sort of tuning into this, what happened earlier this week or late last week was Brendan Shanahan saying that some of the Leafs' young superstars, so you can read between the lines, that's William Nylander, who's still without a contract this year. Don't call it a holdout because it's not. He's just without a contract. Mitch Marner and Austin Matthews. In order to stay together, Brendan Shanahan is saying you're going to need to take a discount because otherwise we won't be able to fit everybody under the salary cap. That's probably true, that they might not be able to fit everybody under the salary cap, or it's going to take some interesting maneuvering. But to say that they have to take a discount, and to use your own example as the reason why they need to take a discount, when you weren't working in a salary cap situation, which the Detroit Red Wings weren't during their heyday, is just completely insulting as far as I'm concerned.
I think what you're hearing from Brendan Shanahan, Drew, is a guy who's frustrated that they haven't signed William Nylander yet. And I realized that the Leafs have got off to the 3-1 start, and they've scored 20 goals in four games, and that's what we expected. I mean, the fact that Austin Matthews is leading the league in goals, and John Tavares is right behind him. Yeah. You've got 13 goals between them in four games.
They've scored the most goals in the league. They've given up the most goals in the league.
So, yeah, that's the funny part, is that they've given up the most goals, and as William Nylander sits without his contract, and the Leafs are piling up goals, but also allowing them.
Yeah, I mean, we'll talk. This isn't so much about the Leafs and their current on-ice performance. It's about Brendan Shanahan and the concept that players need to take a hometown discount, because the Jets themselves are going to be in this situation. I mean, Kyle Connor is off to an incredible start. All he's doing right now is making himself more money and more money and more money at the end of the season. We know that Patrick Laine is going to get demand a huge ticket because he's going to end up with 40 goals or, you know, maybe more, some number like that. But the idea that these players who have a limited shelf life and a limited lifespan need to take a hometown discount because the team president says that's what I would have done or that's what I did in an era that there wasn't a salary cap is just such garbage. I can't even begin to wrap my head around it.
Well, and who is Brendan Shanahan talking about? He's not talking about Austin Matthews. I mean, would any of us be surprised if Austin Matthews gets $12 million a year?
No. I think he might make more than Connor McDavid just because, you know, as the later you sign the contract, the more money it's going to be worth, especially if he puts up, you know, the numbers that he looks like he's going to put up this season.
Well, and is he talking about Mitch Marner? Mitch Marner's probably going to make $8 to $9 million a year.
Sure. He'll be the Draisaitl to Matthews McDavid.
Right? So see where I'm going with this?
Yes,
who's he talking
course.
About? He's talking about William Nylander.
Absolutely.
And apparently William Nylander's asking for $8 million, and I'll tell you now.
Which is absurd.
It is absurd when you're comparing him to, I mean, I think he's very similar to Nikolaj Ehlers. I think he's very similar to David Pastrnak. David Pastrnak put up 80 points last year, making $6.5 million a year. Or I forget what it is, $6.6 million a year. There's no way that William Nylander can say at this stage of his career he's an $8 million a year player. As far as I'm concerned, he's somewhere between $6 and $6.5 million a year.
But he can ask for whatever he wants, and he's not under any obligation to take anything less than what he wants. And for the team president to more or less insult his negotiation and then sort of lay the gauntlet down and challenge Matthews and Marner to also accept less in their negotiation.
See, I don't read it like, I don't think he's challenging Matthews and Marner there.
He's talking about keeping the band together and keeping his young core together. I'll tell you what, you know how you keep your young core together? You don't sign John Tavares. There's $11 million. Mm-hmm. If you want...
Well, no, I don't necessarily agree with that. I think that the fact that John Tavares is making $11 million a year and Patrick Marleau is making $6.2 million a year, I think already right there you have a lot of money tied up in veterans. Obviously, Marleau only has 1 year left on his contract. I mean, Drew, if you don't sign John Tavares, you're not as good. Well, but, so I don't think. But the, I mean, the two are related in the sense that
if you
John Tavares,
sign...
the two are related in the fact that John Tavares makes a lot of money. And again, why are we saying, well, if they didn't, they signed him,
right? But
I mean, they have him. So, I mean, obviously they're going to be right up against the salary cap next year. But if you really want to take that next step, I mean, if the Toronto Maple Leafs went into this year with the same lineup as last year, why would you think they'd be a Stanley Cup contender? They're now a Stanley Cup contender.
But there are going to be trade-offs. And if you sign a guy, you can't have every guy sign for, you know, if you sign Tavares to $11 million, that's a big chunk of money that you're allocating to him.
Yeah, but he's one of the best centers in the league.
I don't have a problem with them signing Tavares. I'm saying I have a problem with them saying to then Matthews, Marner, and Nylander, you now have to take less money because we signed this guy.
I think trading Nylander has to be on the table.
Probably, but it's not. I also don't think that because they signed Tavares for $11 million, that means Austin Matthews needs to take one penny less than Austin Matthews can get on the, well, you know, is deserving to be paid.
And that's why I don't think that he's talking about Austin Matthews. I mean, if Austin Matthews asks for $12 million...
Well, but he's talking about his core.
You have to give it to him.
Maple Leafs president Brendan Shanahan says the team expects its star players to make financial sacrifices to be part of what's hoped will be a long championship window in Toronto.
Well, Shanahan's
that's the opening paragraph.
So that's how they're trying to sell it to the players, is that you take a pay cut and you can be part of a long-standing
winning
team.
Right, and then he goes and talks about his time in Detroit and how all those players, you know, were when we're sitting around, you know, reminiscing about our Stanley Cups, nobody brings up their salaries. Which is such an asinine statement because there wasn't a salary cap then.
I don't think Shanny's being literal here.
Well, I think he is being literal.
I don't think he's saying Austin Matthews should take a hometown discount. I think Austin Matthews is going to get paid what he should be paid.
I can only take it on what he's saying. And the comments he's saying are a shot across the bow of every contract that is negotiated during the window while the Leafs' Stanley Cup possibility is open. For everyone who's going to negotiate a contract with the Leafs for the next year or 2 years, it's a shot across their bow saying, we're going to lowball you because you should take this lowball offer because you want to keep the core together.
Do you actually think that Austin Matthews is going to get paid less than $11 million a year next year?
Do I? No, because I think Austin Matthews and his agent are going to look at those comments and say, who are you kidding? Buddy?
I don't think those comments are going to have any impact
at all. I think those comments are... I don't think ultimately they're going to necessarily impact anything with Marner and Matthews, but I think they're insulting. I think they're insulting to a lot of players in the NHL.
I think they're insulting as well, but what I'm saying is I think you have to take them with a grain of salt. I think you have to take them with a grain of salt Austin Matthews is one of the best centers in the game.
Yeah, okay.
He's one of the best young centers in the game. He's going to get paid, whether that's $11 million a year or $12 million a year, he's going to get paid. So don't expect, you know, there to be a problem between Austin Matthews and the Leafs. I mean, this is a career player. This is a franchise player. It's a guy who's going to play probably his whole career with the Leafs. Now, I think that he's talking about William Nylander here. That's who I think he's talking about.
Continuing on, what I hope is a Shanahan. What I hope is they can look back on 20 years, 30 years down the road, and what's going to be most important to them is whether or not they maxed out as an individual and a team and have championships to look back on and remember fondly. As in, just leave some money on the table and you'll look back fondly. It's just insulting. It's patriarchal. It's just, you know, Austin Matthews has an advisor. He's got an agent who will tell him what's best to do for Austin Matthews. He doesn't need Brendan Shanahan comparing apples to oranges and talking about what's best for Austin Matthews.
You know that Brendan Shanahan's a guy that marches to the beat of his own drum, Drew. So I realize people in Toronto are upset. I realize, you know, there are some outside of Toronto that are upset. I wouldn't get too excited about them, and even if they did offend you,
I just think they're insulting. And last comment on this one, because we have Jeff Baker of the Seattle Times coming up. Last comment, Brendan Shanahan, how did he end up getting to Detroit? because he forced the trade out of Hartford. And how did he get to Hartford? He'd been traded from St. Louis when he signed an offer sheet. So talk about hypocrisy. A guy who demanded a trade and signed an offer sheet is telling young players now what they need to do.
Well, the Red Wings also matched Carolina's offer sheet. And
for Sergei Fedorov.
Sergei Fedorov made, I think it was $24
million. $28 million in that 1 year where they won the Stanley Cup. So talk about hypocrisy, Brendan Shanahan. You know, you're really demonstrating it well with your comments over the last couple weeks.
I didn't get as upset as you, Drew, because I think that, you know, this is a guy that I think has quite frankly had enough of answering questions about William Nylander.
Then trade him or sign him, but don't insult the rest of your young players.
That's why I said a trade is an option here.
When we come back, Jeff Baker of the Seattle Times joins us. We talk about the Seattle expansion bid. Is the 32nd franchise about to come to the Pacific Northwest? You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We are live on TSN Radio 1290.
This is NHL Midweek,
the podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
Hour number two of NHL This Week starts now on TSN 1290. This segment of the show brought to you by Bernstein's Deli, official deli of Illegal Curve Hockey and home of the Illegal Curve Sandwich, located in the Cordon Village Mall. Bernstein's Deli has been Winnipeg's deli destination for over 30 years. For more information, find them on Facebook or at bernsteinsdeli.com. Remember, you can get Bernstein's delivered right to your door. Check out their website, shop.bernsteins.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
From the Seattle Times in the Pacific Northwest, we're pleased to welcome to the program Jeff Baker. Jeff, good evening, and thanks so much for joining us.
No problem. Thanks for having me on.
Our pleasure, Jeff. Obviously, having you on to talk about Seattle and expansion. And from our perspective, at least my perspective, sitting here in Winnipeg, this is a done deal just waiting on the Board of Governors to sign off on it. What's the feeling in the Pacific Northwest? What's the feeling in Seattle? Are they just waiting now for the official announcement?
Yeah, the feeling here is probably the same as in Winnipeg, is that it's a done deal. You know, there's no way the NHL Board of Governors is going to reject a unanimous decision by its executive committee. So, in fact, a few days ago, they just announced a big practice facility that's going to be built here for $70 million. I mean, they're pretty much proceeding as if it is a done deal. And, you know, so it's just a lot of people are interested in it. A lot of people, there are a lot of traditional hockey fans here, but there are also a lot of new fans that are interested in seeing what this new sport is going to be like. And so I'd say there's a good amount of curiosity on all sides of the spectrum.
Jeff, you wrote about this yesterday for the Seattle Times. You wrote about how important it is that the Seattle Arena, the new arena, well, not a new arena, but the renovation of the Key Arena. You mentioned how important it is for the new Seattle team to start for the 2020-21 season, not the 2021-22 season. Can you explain why you think that's important and how it's not just construction delays that could possibly make the 2021 season difficult to attain?
Yeah, I mean, there's a whole lot to go into here, but I mean, the long and the short of it is that the city government has a deal on this $700 million Key Arena renovation because the city owns Key Arena. So they're getting a guaranteed amount of revenue sharing from this arena once it opens up. So the quicker it opens up, the sooner they'll get access to that revenue, the sooner taxpayers will start to reap the benefits of it. And so if they delay it by a year until 2021, you're obviously not going to get a lot of hockey revenue for an extra year. And so that's going to really hurt your revenue projections. As far as the city, they do get a guaranteed minimal amount, but they also get a certain percentage after that minimal amount. And so you'd like that to kick in sooner rather than later. The other thing is and it has been widely reported here and across North America, they had about 33,000 season ticket deposits that were made back in March by people paying between $500 and $1,000 each for those deposits. And, you know, they were told they were going to have a chance to pick their seats out right away at first. You know, it was only going to take a month or two because the people collecting it from the NHL Seattle group here didn't want to make them wait, while they sat on top of about $20 million worth of deposit money. And yet here we are now saying that, well, you might have to wait until 2021-22 to see hockey. I mean, that's holding on to people's money for almost 4 years before you give them a shot at actually turning that money into a ticket and actually using that ticket to go to a game, which is a bit ridiculous. So it's already pushing it that they're going to make them wait about 2.5 years or so before the earliest it can open up. But, I mean, to stretch it to 3 years is a little ridiculous. It's a little crazy. And, you know, let's face it. The NHL has a lot of reasons to actually want to delay this franchise until 2021. Seattle doesn't, but the NHL does. And the biggest is that, you know, you could be having a labor lockout, you know, a lockout or a strike, whatever you want to call it. It's going to be the players that trigger it, most likely, and that's going to happen. You know, we'll know by next September whether that's going to happen, and if it does happen, it could happen as early as September of 2020, which would be a couple of weeks before the Seattle franchise is expected to launch. And so if you're, you know, you're Donald Fehr, you're running the Players Association, you're doing whatever, that's going to be a nice little leverage point, a nice little hammer that you can hold over the owners and say, hey, you don't want us to mess up your new franchise launch in 2020? Well, you know, better give us what we want right now, or else, you know, that's a possibility down the road. And I can bet you the NHL owners don't want to go down that road with the Players Union right now. And so, you know, if you're the NHL, the one way you remove that leverage is to just say, all right, we're not going to start Seattle until October of 2021. So, bang, there goes the Players Union leverage, and you buy yourself a whole other year to try to negotiate a better settlement for the owners. So that's the NHL. You know, it's very likely in the NHL's best interest to delay this by a year. It's not in Seattle's best interest. It's in the NHL's best interest, the NHL owners' best interest, very likely, if they can't resolve any of their labor impasse with the union ahead of time. And, you know, it's going to be crunch time next year. So what the NHL is going to start looking for, I would imagine, if I look into my crystal ball, is going to be to find a reason to delay Seattle until 2021, to take this leverage out of the union's hands. And, you know, what better way to give them an instant excuse than to not have the arena here ready on time if you're Seattle? If you can't get the arena ready on time, then you know, it doesn't matter what your best interests are. The NHL is going to be very smart. They're not going to start the team here on time. But, you know, you take away that excuse for the NHL. If you do get Key Arena on schedule and you do have it starting to get built on time, the NHL is going to have to look for other excuses. And, you know, they're not always great. They've already started tossing a few of them around, one of them being the expansion draft. They say that owners are worried about the expansion draft. They don't want to get fleeced like they did by the Vegas Golden Knights. Well, the answer to that is hire a better general manager or have your general manager work a little harder and don't get fleeced. I mean, you're talking about losing one player who might be like the eighth best guy on your roster. You're not talking about losing your entire team here. The reason the expansion draft exists is to make first-year teams better so they don't suffer the way other first-year teams have suffered in the past. You know, I'll throw Winnipeg in there as well, even though that was as a result of a merger, but I remember the Jets' first season. I remember going to watch them play that first season, and it wasn't pretty. So I watched them in Montreal playing the Canadiens. I think they lost something like probably lost that game 9-3 or something like that, but it was a wipeout. And so, you know, you don't want teams doing that bad when you're charging them $650 million. And so, you know what? Do your job better. The expansion draft, you know, swallow your medicine. Lose the one player and don't try to outthink yourself by making three trades ahead of time to try to save that one player. You know, that's not enough of an excuse to delay the Seattle franchise by a year. These owners have known since last year, they've known for almost a year now, that there's probably going to be a draft ahead of the 2020-21 season expansion draft for Seattle. And, you know, it's their job to get ready. You don't put the franchise off for a year. But that could be the excuse that they use to delay it if Seattle gets its arena on time and if the league really wants to start things a year later so that they don't give the players' union a whole bunch of leverage to use against them, if that makes sense, coming up in contract talks. Because other than that, they're running out of excuses to delay the franchise. Once you get the arena going on schedule here, there's really no reason to start in 2021 unless you're the league and you're looking for an excuse because you don't want to be held hostage by the players' union ahead of the start of that 2020-21 season.
You're listening to NHL.
That was a whole mouthful.
You're listening to NHL This Week. Our guest is Jeff Baker of the Seattle Times talking about the probability of the NHL expanding to Seattle in the next year, 2 years or so.
Jeff, I was reading your article about this new state-of-the-art practice facility in the Northgate Mall in Seattle, which is funny because in Winnipeg we have a Northgate Mall and it's probably the worst mall in Canada. So just to think of a multi-level, multi-faceted arena inside is kind of funny to think about from our perspective. But from your guys' perspective, it really seems like they're trying to make this a community-driven facility, one that not only will help, you know, bring fans into the seats, but really help grow hockey from the grassroots level.
Yeah, I mean, that's been a big thing, especially for the U.S.-based teams, because, you know, unlike Canada, they don't have hockey rinks on every street corner. And even in Canada, where you do have them on every street corner, anybody will tell you getting ice time is very difficult, no matter how many rinks you have. So here, it's extraordinarily difficult. There's only a handful of rinks in the entire southern part of the state of Washington. And so, you know, by adding this facility, they're going to bring three sheets of ice, so three extra rinks, regulation-size rinks, indoors, so that, you know, not only the NHL team will use them. I mean, the NHL team is going to use one of the rinks, the main one, and they're only going to reserve it about 4 hours a day. The rest of the time, that rink's going to be available to the public, and then the two other rinks will be available to the public full-time. And this has been copied, has been done in many cities around the United States. The NHL actually offers a subsidy program now for teams that want to build these facilities because it's in the NHL's best interest. Again, you build these facilities, you grow interest in hockey locally because you have more ice for more kids to play, and then those kids grow up to be season ticket holders, and they'll buy your tickets eventually. But even beyond that, they become great money-making facilities because you're moving, just imagine moving hundreds, if not thousands of people through these facilities every day, not just to play hockey, but to watch practices, usually for free. You can sell sponsorship rights to all kinds of things inside the building. You can sell naming rights to the building itself. They just become cash cows for the team. So it really does become almost a win-win situation where the team's making money off these facilities. They're growing their future hockey fans, and they are giving back to the community by giving them more ice time, you know, to play the game where they don't have it before, especially in a lot of these American cities. I know it's been very successful when they've tried to implement it in the Southern Belt cities. I know in Dallas, they grew the Texas hockey registration exponentially. Same thing in Arizona. And that's why, again, like the league actually does give teams subsidies. I think it's up to something like $5 million a year. It could be like that to build these places.
Jeff, earlier this year, the Seattle ownership group brought in former Dallas Stars, former Arizona Coyotes head coach Dave Tippett as an advisor. Wanted to ask you what the chances are that Dave Tippett could also be the coach of the Seattle NHL expansion team, or do you see him maybe being an advisor to the general manager? And the second part of that question, what's the earliest we could see Seattle name a general manager?
Boy, there's a whole lot in there, but I will unpack it. Look, I had lunch early on with Dave Tippett, and I've, you know, come across him many, many times since he came here to the market, including two nights ago. And he's been very upfront about it. He actually likes not being the coach right now. You know, he likes the free time he has. He likes playing golf when he wants to play it. He's gotten back into hockey in this level because he missed it. He wasn't ready to retire yet. But, you know, he's not sure himself whether he wants to go back behind the bench into this all-consuming type of job that would be awaiting him there. And so, I would say right now it's, you know, even calling it 50-50 might be a little much because he's not going to have the final say. The general manager will, of course, get to make the call on who the head coach is going to be. It just might be that Tippett takes to liking life here in Seattle as an advisor in the front office, in the management end of things. He told me he's always been fascinated, been intrigued by the business side of stuff. Back when he played for the Hartford Whalers, he used to run a construction, he started his own construction business and started building homes, and he was making more money building homes in the summertime than he was playing hockey the rest of the year back then. Things have changed a little in the CBA front, but, yeah, you know, the point being, he's always had an inner interest in the business end of things. So I think, I think he has to see this process through and see whether he really wants to do this after he's done it for about a year or more. And then when they start looking for the coach, he can throw his hat in the ring if he wants to at that point. But I'm not sure he's made up his own mind as of yet of whether he's ready to go back 100% into that behind the bench job that he had before, or whether he wouldn't rather, you know, I don't want to call it a cushy job, but you know, it's not the same when you don't have to stay up till 5 a.m. watching film, because you got practice the next day and then a game to prepare for after that. When you're doing the business side of it, it's a little more normal on your lifestyle, a little easier on the travel. And, he's getting into an age where, you know, these things are a consideration. As far as the general manager goes, I think Stevie Yzerman has to be the number one contender. I would say that right now because of just the situation that you've got going. I mean, the other name we keep hearing is Ken Holland. But Holland's got 2 years left on his deal in Detroit, whereas Yzerman is just backed away from his job with the Lightning, and now he's serving as an advisor. So, you know, once the new team's awarded, and you get to the end of this current NHL season, Yzerman's going to become a free agent on the general manager's front. And, you know, Todd Leiwicki, who's the president and CEO of the Seattle group here, worked closely with Steve Yzerman when he was general manager of the Lightning, and Leiwicki was the CEO of the Lightning. So they have a very good relationship. Everybody in the Seattle organization talks up Yzerman to the hilt. So in my personal rankings, I'm not claiming I have this as inside knowledge, but I would say that he has to be at the top of the heap. And I would say that towards the end of the hockey season, to the point where it doesn't become a distraction for the Lightning, you would see Seattle, you know, make an official play for a general manager, I would think.
Last question.
I still believe Yzerman's technically under contract in Tampa for another year.
Last question for you, Jeff, and we really appreciate your time. What do you think the nickname of this team is going to be? We've heard Seattle, what, Sockeyes? We've heard the Metropolitans. There's the history with that. Do the fans have a favorite, and what do you think it's going to be?
Well, the Seattle Times just had a fan vote, and we had over 100, and I think it was 142,000 people participated in this, and they chose the Sockeyes. They ended up winning over all the other names that you just mentioned, and some more intriguing ones. The Kraken is a very popular name, not only because it was in Jerry Bruckheimer's Pirates of the Caribbean films, and he's going to be one of the owners here in Seattle, but people just think it's cool, it's different, it's rebellious. I can tell you it's not going to be the Kraken, because I've heard that from too many people inside the Seattle group that they don't want to treat this thing like a joke. They want to take it seriously. And so I would say Sockeyes would be up there. Metropolitans would still be up there. That's there is the history, the ties to the hockey past here. The one difficulty with Metropolitans is the New York Mets already own that name, so there could be trademark issues that they would have to work through, and as far as I've been able to determine, nobody has started any conversations on that front. So I would say if it's not Metropolitans, it would be some kind of a fish-related name, like Sockeyes or Steelheads, but there could be trademark issue with that. So we'll see. There's it would probably be some kind of name akin to the Northwest here with a probably a fish-related thing. The other thing we hear is Totems, which was the name of the minor hockey and the junior team years and years ago down here. You know, that could get a little sensitive with Native American groups. Sometimes, it's best not to start messing around with those and appropriating symbols and stuff as a professional hockey logo. But, that's the other name that's come up quite a bit.
Well, Jeff, even if Seattle's NHL team isn't going to be called Kraken, we're still going to pop a little Kraken rum after tonight's show. So
I'm sure Jeff cares about that. Jeff Baker from the Seattle.
That's good, guys.
It's a good drink.
Jeff Baker from the Seattle Times. Thanks very much for joining us this evening on NHL This Week.
All right, thanks, guys.
Take care, Jeff. When we come back, it's been an injury-riddled first week of the NHL season. We break down some of the injuries, which ones are the most significant. You're listening to NHL This Week. We're live on TSN Radio 1290.
This is NHL Midweek,
the podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
Luongo down again. Two of his teammates bumping into him, and he's shaken up. And back comes Dave DiNapoli, the head trainer of the Panthers, to check on him.
The injury bug struck early and often to start this year. Roberto Luongo, Florida Panthers goaltender, goes out on the IR. He's going to miss 2 to 4 weeks with a strained MCL. Welcome back to NHL This Week. This segment brought to you by Frank and Mauro Zappia of Zappia Group Realty, official realtors of Illegal Curve Hockey. When 95% of your clients come via referral, it shows your commitment to honesty, integrity, and a total dedication to client satisfaction. For all your real estate needs, come shake hands with Frank and Mauro Zappia online at zappiagroup.com.
How good is that Michael Hutchinson acquisition looking now?
Well, you know, it was curious that when they signed Hutchinson to a contract in the offseason as a free agent, that why would they pay Michael Hutchinson $1.3 million or whatever they're paying him to be their number three goaltender? Well, lo and behold, I guess I guess with Roberto Luongo, the writing is always on the wall that he's going to miss some amount of games with an injury.
It's really unfortunate for him, by the way.
Very unfortunate. But every year he at least misses, 2 to 4 weeks or 4 to 6 weeks with, as he gets older, it's a hip injury or it's a groin injury or it's a knee injury, whatever it is. So now they have Reimer and Hutchinson as opposed to having Reimer and well, whoever, you know, the Hutchinson's backup would be at the AHL level. I don't even know who that would be at that point in time. So,
isn't it Harry Sateri?
Is it Harry Sateri?
Oh, I love that name.
It could be. That actually sounds like it sounds plausible that he might be the backup to Michael Hutchinson in the AHL.
We talked about him because he's from Finland.
Yes.
And the Panthers are going to Finland.
Also, his name is Harry Sateri.
Right.
Anytime you can throw that name in there.
Well, all names that rhyme are awesome.
Right. So, Luongo obviously out, like I mentioned, 2 to 4 weeks. Matt Murray's got another concussion. He's out indefinitely. Who knows when he's going to play next? Jonathan Quick, he's week to week with a lower body injury. That happened in practice for the Kings. That's why we saw Jack Campbell in net for the Kings against the Jets last night. So three serious goaltender injuries right in the first week of the season.
Well, we talked about it during the first segment. I mean, not only do you have a first-round pick in Jack Campbell that's able to step in, but you have Peter Budaj there,
who is also very good for them.
Right? So if you're looking at all of these injuries and you're asking Shawnee and I, you know, which situation to me is the most concerning, mm-hmm. for me, it's easy. It's Pittsburgh.
Yeah.
Matt Murray is now on his third concussion. He's had two concussions in the last year, and you remember it happened in practice, but he was also run into by another player the first time.
Mm-hmm.
So when you're 24 years old and you've already had three concussions and you don't have a proven NHL backup, you look at Casey DeSmith and Tristan Jarry.
Yeah.
I mean, mm-hmm. you've got, what, 35 games of NHL experience there?
Only because Murray was injured last year. I mean, that's right. the same problem they're running into in Pittsburgh.
Well, Andrew, we don't know how long Matt Murray's going to be out for, but
you
if
never
Matt
know.
Murray's even out for 2 to 3 weeks... And you look at the Pittsburgh Penguins, they've been giving up a lot of goals.
Sure.
I mean, we'll talk about it next segment, but Olli Mäntä is going to be a healthy scratch tomorrow.
Yeah, we're going to be joined by Seth Rohrabaugh, who covers the Penguins for TheAthletic.com, coming up at the bottom of the hour. But you're absolutely right, Ezzy. I mean, you have, when they traded Marc-Andre Fleury to Vegas, that was because Matt Murray was ready to step in and take over, which made sense because he had the great playoff performances for the Penguins. But he's another guy, you know, concussions. And with concussions, you never know. And when you suffer one and then two, you're more susceptible to suffering your third concussion. And, you know, what the Penguins are going to have to tread water without him or hope that DeSmith or Jerry, you know, can pick it up and all of a sudden become what they haven't been before, which is an NHL regular goaltender.
Right, Shawnee. And, you know, we can get to, you know, James Van Riemsdyk and some of the other injuries. But mm-hmm. if you're looking at the three goalies that are injured, Luongo, Quick, and Matt Murray, Luongo and Quick were both injured last year.
Mm-hmm.
And we knew that Luongo
so
wasn't
was Murray.
Right, but he wasn't out for
as long as they
right?
Were, yeah,
so
right.
when you're talking about, you know, Luongo, you knew that, you know, he probably wasn't going to play more than, what, 50 games? I mean, you can't expect Luongo to play mm-hmm. 60 games at 39 years old. And when you're talking about Jonathan Quick, I mean, Jonathan Quick is a guy that can play 60, 65 games a year, but you knew that you had a capable backup in Jack Campbell, and then you also had Peter Budaj. People forget Peter Budaj did an admirable job last year filling in for Jonathan Quick. And when you have guys like Drew Doughty and Alec Martinez, Jake Muzzin in front of you, they've got a really solid defensive structure there. But, you know, the Penguins need Matt Murray to get back to his form from a couple of years ago when they won the Stanley Cup, Shawnee, because last year his regular season numbers were not as good as they were the year they won the Stanley Cup. So I'm the most concerned about that situation, because I think if you're asking Casey DeSmith and Tristan Jarry to play significant amount of games this year, I think that's going to be a problem for Pittsburgh. They're not the best defensive team.
Yeah, quickly looking at some of the other injuries, Brandon Dubinsky, he's out 4 to 6 weeks with Columbus. They've already been hit by the bug. They already lost Seth Jones in the preseason. Dubinsky's got a strained oblique. James Van Riemsdyk, lower body injury, 5 to 6 weeks. Joe Thornton, he's on the IR.
Knee infection.
Knee infection after, you know, suffering, you know, he had so many off-season surgeries, and then that knee, he's had issues and structural issues. You wonder, I mean, it's an infection, so can they treat it with antibiotics? But you wonder, a guy who's getting older, what does that really mean? And then Travis Hamonic, he gets into the fight with Eric Gudbrandsson the first game of the season, and boom, he's on the IR with a broken face.
Yeah, and Winnipegger Nolan Patrick leaving tonight's Ottawa Flyers game. Apparently only played 3 minutes and 30 seconds, and then went back into the tunnel, did not return for the start of the second, and won't return for the remainder of the game. Here's a guy who's battled his fair share of injuries as well, Winnipegger, and you just hope that it's nothing reoccurring.
Well, that's two players, two forwards, two guys from their top nine, certainly, mm-hmm. in Van Riemsdyk and now Nolan Patrick, that are out of the Flyers lineup. So the injury bug biting early, biting often in this first week or first week of games here to start the NHL season.
Right, guys, and you never want to see players get injured, but the positive that comes out of this is it's an opportunity for other players, right? So in Philly, you're talking about a guy like Jordan Wheel, who gets to now play more games than he would if James Riemsdyk was in the lineup, right? So if you're a guy like Tristan Jarry, you're not playing in the American Hockey League, you're playing in the NHL. So you never want to see players injured, but there's always opportunities for other players when a player gets injured.
A great point, as you think about Kyle Connor last year. Didn't make the team out of training camp. Matty Perreault goes down, he comes up. 31-goal rookie season. He'll never see the AHL again.
You're right about that. When we come back, Seth Rorabaugh of TheAthletic.com joins us to talk about the Pittsburgh Penguins. You're listening to NHL This Week. We are live on TSN Radio 1290.
This is NHL Midweek,
the podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
Bottom of the hour. Welcome back to NHL This Week. This segment brought to you by our good friends at Keener Jerseys, specializing in customization services and branded team apparel. Keener Jerseys is changing the game with world-class craftsmanship and unparalleled service. If you want awesome jerseys for your rec team or have a jersey you want personalized, visit KeenerJerseys.com or check out their showroom at 982 Portage Avenue. That's the corner of Portage and Sherburn. Tell them that Illegal Curve sent you.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
From TheAthletic.com in Pittsburgh, we're pleased to welcome back to the program Seth Rorabaugh. Seth, good evening, and thanks so much for joining us. How are you?
Real well. Thanks for having me, guys.
Our pleasure. Seth obviously brought you on. Talk a little bit about the Pittsburgh Penguins at the start of the 2018-19 season. And unfortunately for the Penguins, we have to start on a sour note, that being, of course, the concussion suffered by Matt Murray. He's going to be out of the lineup now for an indefinite period of time. Obviously serious, given that this is not his first concussion, and you know it's beginning to, when you can count up the number of concussions a player has suffered, it gets to be nerve-wracking for that player. You know, how detrimental to the Penguins is this injury to Matt Murray?
Well, I mean, it's clearly a downgrading goal. You know, they go to Casey DeSmith, who's a kind of an undrafted guy who out of college had to get an ECHL contract, or tryout actually, at the ECHL level. It turned out into an AHL deal and eventually an NHL deal. And he surprised a lot of people. He showed that he belongs in the NHL, but clearly it's a downgrading goal when you lose Matt Murray for an indefinite period of time, especially when you look at Matt Murray's resume and some of the things he's been able to do at the NHL level. But as you touched on there, maybe a bigger issue or a more concerning issue just based on his long-term health. This is his third concussion in what I would say is probably the equivalent of three seasons. Going back to his rookie season of late in 15-16. And, suffering, that many concussions in such a finite period of time, that's not good. I mean, it's not good to suffer any concussions under any circumstances, but when you start piling them up in a really, segmented period of time, that can complicate things. So, and when you also factor in he's had a lot of other issues in terms of, like, knee injuries, leg injuries, so on and so forth. I think he broke his hand in the World Cup 1 year too as well. So this is a guy, for all his tremendous success early in his career, the one thing that's maybe been a minus for him, probably the biggest minus for him, is just his health. He's never really been a guy renowned for his durability, and he's getting off to this season on a really sour note with this concussion.
Seth, how surprised were you when you heard that defenseman Olli Maatta was going to be a healthy scratch tomorrow against the Golden Knights? And a second part of that question, what can you tell us about Juuso Rikkola, a guy that's undrafted, and quite frankly, I don't know a lot about him?
I was surprised by Olli Maatta. I mean, he played poorly in the Montreal game, but he wasn't in exclusive company there. I mean, they pretty much had a really rotten game against Montreal this past week, and it was on Saturday night, actually, and he was on the ice for two goals against. It looked pretty bad, but he was out there with Jack Johnson too, and that's a fairly new defensive pairing, and neither player looked good on the goal. Would probably argue all 20 players, minus the backup goalie that night, all looked pretty bad at the lineup that night, and so I think it might be a little bit unfair to pin it on Olli Maatta and say, oh, he was the reason they had a bad game. I mean, they all had a bad game. I don't want to say slow behind the play in some instances. And as you mentioned, Juuso Rikkola is the guy who's probably going to fit in here. This guy played for Sami Kapanen, actually, over in Finland the last 4 years. A guy they signed just this past summer. Was undrafted, and the guy they got as a free agent. He's kind of like a nice all-around player. He had a really strong preseason. He was really kind of
the unofficial star or MVP of their preseason here. Can do a little bit of everything. He's a left-handed shot, but he can play both sides. Has a nice shot. He's able to kind of find some of those openings and, you know, be able to time them, you know, shooting from the point. Isn't afraid to mix it up, you know, get physical, throw big hits. Can skate pretty well. Skates more than capably for a defenseman in the modern NHL. So we're going to see his first taste of NHL action. I remember I actually talked to Sammy Kapanen in the summer, and he said he's a guy who, yeah, he has all the skill set. It just might take him a little while to get used to the NHL. Well, he was lights out in the preseason. It looked like there was very little adjustment time for him, and he looks more than ready to get his first taste of, real NHL action.
You know, Seth, concussions are scary injuries just with regards to duration and especially repeats. And, you know, when you hear about a goaltender suffering a concussion, it's so unnerving. But just think about Matt Murray, and something that came to my mind earlier today, just does he have maybe a perfect guy to support him through this in Sidney Crosby, a guy who has had multiple concussions, some of which were potentially, you know, some people thought maybe career-ending?
Yeah, Sidney Crosby's, you know, for all the, you know, people that wonder about what kind of leader he is, he's not a Mark Messier guy, you know, rah-rah, let's go get him in the locker room, you know, fiery speeches. He's a guy who, you know, he might pull a teammate aside in private and talk to them about an issue or something like that. In fact, you know, I talked to Zach Aston-Reese during training camp. He kind of famously suffered a broken jaw after being hit by Tom Wilson in the playoffs last year. And, you know, Sidney Crosby himself dealt with a broken jaw when he got hit in the face with a slap shot a few years ago. And, you know, Zach Aston-Reese told me he's a guy who kind of, Sid kind of reached out to him and kind of gave him some tips on how to eat, you know, food when you have a broken jaw, what type of, how to make milkshakes and stuff like that. And, you know, just kind of little everyday things, you know, speaking from experience. And I know I've talked to other players who have dealt with concussions on the Penguins rosters over the years, and they said Sidney Crosby's kind of reached out to him and been proactive and you know, giving him some advice or even, you know, maybe talking to a certain doctor or what have you. So, no, that's a very good comparison there or statement, I guess, you made there, saying Sidney Crosby's the perfect guy to talk to. And just based on the fact that Sid's very proactive in dealing with teammates that way, and especially when it comes to maybe an ailment or something that he has personal experience with.
Seth Rohrbaugh is our guest on NHL this week. We're talking about the Pittsburgh Penguins. Seth, of course, is an editor for TheAthletic.com in Pittsburgh. Yeah, Seth, during the offseason, there was a lot of chatter about Phil Kessel, a lot of chatter about his relationship with the team, with Mike Sullivan in particular. What adjective would you use to describe that relationship so far this year?
I'm going to use a noun, actually, friction. I think there's always going to be friction there. Mike Sullivan's a very organized kind of by the minute type of person, and Phil Kessel's not. He's kind of an easygoing, come as you are type of person. That's not to say Phil's not committed to his craft and is not an outstanding player and not someone that can't help them win. But you know, I think you have two very different personalities with Phil Kessel and Mike Sullivan. You know, Mike Sullivan's a guy who, if he has 45 minutes scheduled for practice, he makes sure all 45 minutes, all those minutes are used for improving the team or improving players individually. Whereas, you know, I'm not trying to label Phil Kessel as lazy or any of those, you know, kind of, typical narratives that we always hear with Phil Kessel, but he's just not a guy I think it's as attentive to detail as someone like Mike Sullivan would have. So I think that's where sometimes a lot of the friction exists. You know, whether or not the Penguins seriously entertained offers for dealing Phil Kessel this past offseason, it depends on who you talk to. I've heard some things that would indicate yes, some things that would indicate no, but I know it's something that they don't necessarily roll out if it ever, you know, if the right deal ever comes along. But I think all parties involved, Phil Kessel and Mike Sullivan namely, realize there's a lot of benefit that this imperfect marriage can still offer, and they're willing to live with whatever friction does exist between the two.
Now, Seth, it's only a few games into the season, but what's your assessment of Daniel Sprong? This is a player that we've talked about for many years. I think you'd agree that he was rushed into the NHL 3 years ago. It's a guy who was drafted in the second round in 2015, put up really good numbers for the Charlottetown Islanders in the QMJHL. Is this a guy that you still see being a top six player for the Penguins?
Not at the time being, just based on the Penguins' depth. I mean, especially when you look at the right wing position, I mean, you have Patrick Hornquist on the top line, and he might be the best net front guy in the NHL. Then you have Phil Kessel and his amazing talents, on the second line there. So, And even then, they have Brian Rust, who the coaches really like on the third line wing, right wing. So for the time being, Daniel Sprong is a fourth line right winger. And I realize, too, fourth lines in the NHL this day and age, you don't have the muckers and grinders, the guys that are basically just kind of PK guys and guys who might fight or whatever. I realize maybe offensive fourth lines are expected to kind of be a little bit more offensive in nature these days, but I'm not quite sure you're maximizing his talents right now using him on the fourth line. And at the same time, too, he's no longer exempt from waivers. So if they wanted to send him to Wilkes-Barre Scranton, they would likely lose him through waivers. So they're kind of stuck with him on the NHL roster at the time. But he has two assists in two games so far, and he's a point-per-game player. Something to be said for that right now. But I really can't say he's made an immense impact through all two games thus far. I still think he's a work in progress, and he's a guy that I don't think the coaches necessarily trust. I think they're just assigned to the fact that they're kind of stuck with him right now just based on the roster situation. But still very much a work in progress. The talent's there. He has a really special shot. It's hard to explain, really. I mean, when it comes off his stick, it just comes off differently than when, maybe, say, most other players in the league. I would say, really, aside from Phil Kessel, he might have the best shot on the team, just in terms of placement and velocity and all those things. And it's just a matter of him, maximizing the opportunities that he gets to put it on net. And I think also, too, there's still the details of the game, particularly defensively, that he still works on. There's times when when he looks like he's been reminded to, you have to back check. You have to go back to the ice and help your defenseman out. And he'll be on his horse and he'll do everything right. Then there's the next shift where he just kind of loses sight of that and won't do that. So trying to be maybe attentive to detail 100% of the times may be a big issue for him. But clearly the talent's still there. If he were to go in the American League right now, he'd probably be a 30-goal guy and be the leading scorer, one of the leading scorers in that league. But circumstances really are preventing him from going there and maybe furthering his development there. And for the time being, they're just kind of stuck with him on the fourth line.
Seth, how's Jack Johnson's transition going to the blue line?
I think it's been okay. It's been a bit of a mixed bag. I thought he was actually one of their best defensemen in the season opener against Washington. It was a 7-6 game, and you think there's not much defense in that game. But he was actually one of the more stable, quieter entities in that game. And by quiet, I mean he didn't make many mistakes. Didn't really push many things offensively or anything like that. But I think he had the third most time on the ice in that game after Chris Letang and Sidney Crosby. So that clearly illustrated some level of trust there that the coaches have in him already. In the second game, as I mentioned earlier, him and Mata didn't really gel that well against Montreal, and they had a couple of mistakes, turnovers, whatnot. But we're going to see him play with Yusuf Rico, actually. It looks like tomorrow night against, I guess. But I think the big thing for him is that he's not going to be expected to do what he did in Columbus before things went poor there. He's not going to be a guy playing 28 minutes a night and expected to play in all situations. He's going to play, at most, a number three or four defensive role. He'll be asked to do less. And I think we've seen in precedent here in Pittsburgh with guys like Justin Schultz or Jamie Oleksiak, where if you put a talented player like that in a lesser role, I think it less is more a lot of times. So he's going to be expected to do a little bit less than he was expected to do in Columbus and Los Angeles. And, hopefully, presumably under the tutelage of Jacques Martin as well as Sergei Gonchar, he'll be able to kind of reclaim his career here and, reestablish his credentials as an NHLer. But through all two real games, I think it's been a bit of a mixed bag. But if nothing else, he clearly has the trust of the coaching staff already.
And last question for you, Seth. You have a great article today on theathletic.com, and we'll send out a tweet to it or a link to it via our Twitter feed, @IllegalCurve, momentarily, talking about how players, when they're traded, how they go from the mentality of us, being on a different team to now being one of them. Talk about the article, if you don't mind, and sort of what was your biggest surprise in finding out how quickly it takes players to acclimatize to a new situation and a new group of teammates?
Well, my colleague wrote a story about Marc-Andre Fleury returning to Pittsburgh tomorrow, actually, with Las Vegas for the second time. And even after a year of tremendous year in Las Vegas, they go to the Stanley Cup Final, an expansion team, all that stuff. He kind of still catches himself talking about Pittsburgh as us or, we or whatever, using those type of pronouns. And he has to kind of catch himself to realize, I'm not there anymore. So I kind of went around the room and I asked, a couple guys on the Penguins roster, current roster, about, what that transition is like. And I think the biggest thing was if you were traded midseason, maybe that transition maybe a little bit gummy sometimes. But if you're in a situation like, say, Jack Johnson, where you know that's going to be your last year in Columbus, you can't wait to get somewhere else. And you know, that transition of thinking about your former team is almost automatic. So to me, I guess the difference being very vivid in terms of whether or not you were liking your city, or you're on your way out, or if you're a free agent, versus maybe kind of an improbable midseason trade. To me, I think that was probably the biggest difference that really stood out to me in terms of how you regard your former team once you leave them.
Seth Rohrabaugh covers the Pittsburgh Penguins for TheAthletic.com in Pittsburgh. Seth, always appreciate your time and your insight. Thanks so much for joining us this evening on NHL This Week.
I appreciate you guys. Take care.
Take care, Seth. When we come back, we talk about the Carolina Hurricanes. They're off to a great start this season. More importantly than their on-ice performance is their post-game on-ice celebration. We talk about that next. You're listening to NHL This Week. We're live on TSN Radio 1290.
This is NHL Midweek, the podcast on TSN1290.ca.
Here they come. The surge is on.
Well, that was an interesting clip of audio.
Fogle's got some air.
Fogle got some air. It's a wave of players. I'll explain it all momentarily. Welcome back to NHL This Week. One final segment on this Wednesday evening. A quick programming note. Saturday's Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Note the start time. 8 a.m. to 11 a.m. on Saturday. We'll get you ready for Sunday's home game against the Carolina Hurricanes, because 11 o'clock on Saturday, of course, blue and gold game day with Bombing Westy and Walby, as the Bombers have that home game against the Saskatchewan Roughriders at 1 o'clock. So we'll be on 8 a.m. on
Banjo Bowl, too.
Banjo Bowl, yes, Redux. Banjo Bowl, the Revenge, or something like that. Anyways, 8 a.m. for the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on Saturday morning. This,
you know,
segment,
what, Drew? Sorry,
can I just finish my promo here? Is that okay? Can I finish the promo? You okay with that, or you just want to jump right all over me?
Well, I'm not jumping all over you.
No.
I'm sitting here beside you.
You're verbally jumping all over me.
I was just going to say, the 8 o'clock start, yeah. Since I've had a daughter, is not going to be as big of a deal. I used to, dread the 8 o'clock start.
Yes. Now you're a mature...
Now I look forward to it.
Yeah, you're a mature...
Because I'm up at 6:30.
You're a mature functioning member of society now, and we all welcome you to the, to that milestone in life.
Yep. I've got a dad bod just like you.
You got something, all right. This segment of the show, brought to you by Rumors Restaurant and Comedy Club, officially declared the funniest place in Winnipeg by Illegal Curve Hockey. For over 30 years, Rumors has been bringing Winnipeg the best in stand-up comedy. To purchase tickets or for a list of performers and showtimes, visit RumorsComedyClub.com. All this week at Rumors, he was here last week as well. One of my all-time favorites. I go way back with this guy. Pete Zedlacker is in town. A fantastic comedian. This weekend at the club, he's actually recording a live album. So you go see Pete Zedlacker, you buy his album, and then you can hear yourself laughing while at a comedy club while listening to a comedy album. How about that? How is that for going deep down the rabbit hole? So Pete Zedlacker at Rumors all week long. Tickets available at rumorscomedyclub.com. So the clip that we played off the top is the Carolina Hurricanes off to a good start this year, and the way they celebrate their victories. So, what happens nowadays is a team goes to center ice and the horn sounds and they wave their sticks and then they skate off and nobody cares. Now the Hurricanes have one player go to center ice and get the fans to all start clapping, like doing the Vikings
slow clap,
skull clap, over the head, like you saw Wheeler doing on the bench in St. Paul last year, right before the Vikings Saints playoff game. You know what the skull clap looks like. So a player does that, gets all the fans going at it. Then at the count of three, the entire team skates from the blue line to the opposite end of the ice and jumps into the boards.
Isn't that how Andrei Svechnikov celebrated his first goal in the NHL?
He celebrated it during the game, when he scored that first goal, the first player to ever, born in the 2000s, mm-hmm. to ever score in the NHL.
He's a beast, that guy.
He is going to be a
kid.
Yeah, he's a kid. I mean, he's 18 years old.
How old did you feel right there saying that?
Very old. The first player to score who was born in the 2000s? It's not possible.
I graduated in 2000.
I can't believe you graduated. That's the more important story. Stop the show. Stop the presses. You graduated?
Drew, I love this celebration. And if anybody doesn't, the same people that don't like this celebration are the same people that didn't like the pregame ceremonies in Vegas. I loved the pregame ceremonies. This is fun.
It is fun.
And the Carolina Hurricanes are a team that have missed the playoffs for the last 9 years.
Yeah.
Nine. That's a long time. And as far as I'm concerned, you know, if you're picking up on Andrei Svechnikov's celebration, and Justin Williams was interviewed a couple of days ago talking about it, and he said, you know, he's the captain, of course, and he talked to management, and management kind of gave him the go-ahead, because Justin Williams has been leading this.
Yeah.
Right? And you expect the leaders in the dressing room to be leading this. Justin Williams is a guy, if you remember, who won the Cup back in 2006.
Multiple Stanley Cups.
Right? So, I mean, this isn't a novelty act. I mean, they're going to do this. And why not? If this is something that they can really, you know, kind of galvanizes the team.
It galvanizes the team.
It's
fun for the crowd. This is hockey. We're not, you know, we're not doing brain surgery here. Let's have some fun with the game. We're seeing it. I don't know if you've seen the video. It just came out, you know, maybe 3 hours ago on Bar Down of Patrick Laine.
Grease Laine.
To, you know, a takeoff of Grease Lightning from the musical Grease.
Well, and
it's Grease Laine. So, I mean, we encourage you to check that out, featuring former Illegal Curve intern Jesse Pollock,
right,
starring in that video.
It's hilarious. You know, I was just going to say, I don't think they're going to be doing this on the road, too. This is just
at home. No, it's just at home. It's
right?
just at home. You're not going to.
Yeah, gonna, so it's.
You're doing something for your hometown crowd.
Yeah,
These people are paying lots of money to watch. Frankly, you know, 82 games is too many, so you're watching sometimes a lot of meaningless hockey.
Yep.
Let's have some fun with it. Mm-hmm. Let's do something that's maybe giving people a little bit more of their money's worth. You know, when we were in Dallas this past weekend, I really liked the Dallas game ops, the way they presented the game. It was, you know, they had some funny aspects to it. Let's make it fun for the people in the audience, so it's not just about the hockey only.
Who was the guy wearing the shirt that said Winnipeg has a hockey team? Because that guy was amazing.
Well, so this guy, I'm sitting in my seats, or we're sitting in the seats before the game, and I don't know why I was the only one in the seats at that point in time. I think everybody else had left me for some reason.
Babysitting your beer.
Apparently, no, I was drinking that beer, let me tell you. This guy just walks past me, and I say, hey, buddy, do you mind if I snap a photo? So I took a photo of him, and I sent it out on my Twitter feed, @ICDrew, free shameless plug right there. And people got mad, as you know people on Twitter are going to do, is they got mad. How dare this guy be so rude to Winnipeg? We were in the playoffs. Take it easy,
yeah,
people.
Like,
the guy's having some funny. Photobombed our group photo at the game
picture.
In Dallas.
It's a great picture.
So there's all of us around our buddy, you know, celebrating his bachelor party, and one guy in the corner wearing Winnipeg has a hockey team on his T-shirt.
What about the girl that took that picture? Took a selfie right before she took the picture.
Yeah, well, that also happened. We asked her to snap a photo of us. She took a selfie first. It's having fun, people. Life sucks a lot nowadays. Let's have some fun when we can get some opportunities to do so.
Whoa.
Well, I mean, it does.
Yeah,
you know,
speak for yourself, Drew.
Well, life sucks in the...
Shawnee and I are living our best life.
It sucks in the Donald Trump sense of the word. How about that? If you understand what I'm saying. That's it for this edition of NHL This Week. A big thank you to our guests, Jeff Baker, Seth Rorabaugh, Willie Donick. In case you missed any of the show, it'll be available for download on TSN1290.ca, on our website, or wherever you get your podcasts. Big thank you to our sponsors, Rumors Restaurant and Comedy Club, Linden Market Dental Center, Bernstein's Deli, Zappia Group Realty, and Keener Jerseys. Support these fine local businesses because they support Illegal Curve Hockey. Big props to producer James Doroshuk, doing a great job behind the board. For Sean Asor, for Ezra Ginsberg, I'm your host, Drew Mandel. Until Saturday at 8 a.m., we wish you good night and good luck.